It's 6 minutes after 12. This is a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas, 91.3 KUAF. This is Ozarks at Large for Tuesday, February 5th, 2019. Ahead this hour, John Brumma, political writer for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, sits down with Roby Brock from our partner Talk Business and Politics to discuss the week in politics from the Capitol in Little Rock to Washington, D.C. And after our show this afternoon on NPR's Here and Now, all the recent volatility in the stock market has made it tricky for people trying to manage their finances. We'll hear from expert and author Jill Schlesinger about how to handle your money without letting it take over your life. Here and now, this afternoon at 1, right after Ozarks at Large. Benton County Judge's Office launches a series of town halls tonight to tell voters more about a special election that would increase the sales tax by an eighth of a cent in order to fund the construction of a new courthouse that would be built near the historic courthouse on the Bentonville Square. The facility is expected to cost about $30 million. The sales tax would sunset after 4.5 years. The first town hall is at the Gravett Civic Center at 6 tonight. Tomorrow, another at Northeast Benton County Volunteer Fire Department in Garfield. That one tomorrow night, also at 6. And if you'd like to hear more about the courthouse proposal, you can go to OzarksAtLarge.com to listen to a story produced by Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek that aired on last Wednesday's episode of Ozarks at Large. For 25 years, the Business Forecast Luncheon has provided a global, national, state, and regional economic outlook. Last Friday, Mervin Jebaraj provided the local forecast. He's director of the Center for Business and Economic Research in the Sam M. Walton College of Business at the University of Arkansas. Yesterday afternoon, he stopped by Studio 123 to speak with Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda about this year's findings.
It provides an opportunity at the beginning of the year for business leaders, community leaders to get together and listen to what the economy may look like through the rest of the year and help them make better business decisions or better decisions for their communities.
And so you focused on Northwest Arkansas.
I focused on Northwest Arkansas and Arkansas.
And what sort of metrics do you look at when you're forecasting?
We mostly just predict the employment outlook, and then we talk about how the economy has performed in the last year and where we think the economy is going in the last year, so in the next year. So we project Arkansas employment, which this year we're projecting about 11,000 jobs to be added for the state in 2019, and from Northwest Arkansas about 5,000 jobs. If you're, you know, thinking about that, it's about half the jobs in the state come from Northwest Arkansas.
That seems very... That's such a large amount. Is that strange?
That's been the story of this economic recovery and the past several years. In fact, this is one of the lower percentages of employment that Northwest Arkansas makes up of the state. It's been 60% or more in previous years.
Oh, wow.
So really, when you look at employment projections, whether you're looking at what's going to happen in the upcoming year or what's happened in previous years, Northwest Arkansas makes up about close to half the jobs. Little Rock and Jonesboro make up the rest of them. And then the other regions typically subtract jobs from the Arkansas total, which is where you end up with 11,000 jobs in Arkansas. So you get 5,000 from Northwest Arkansas, 7,000 or so from Little Rock, about 1,300 from Jonesboro. And then, if you're lucky, about 500 jobs plus or minus from Fort Smith, Hot Springs, and Pine Bluff, and then the rural areas have typically lost jobs from that total. So,
and so when you say subtract, that would represent, say, a manufacturer closing down and the jobs being lost.
Right. And so actually, when you think about the state's weakest economy is probably the Pine Bluff metro area, and manufacturing employment has stayed steady in 2018, which is good news. Most of the jobs lost were in the services sector, so it's people having restaurants and stuff that serve the people that live there. That's where we've seen the closures in 2018.
Having half of the jobs in the state seems like a positive thing. Is there a downside?
Northwest Arkansas, it is positive. Certainly you want to be in a region that's adding jobs and not one that's losing jobs. But I always like to say, in Northwest Arkansas's name is the word Arkansas, and so what happens in the rest of the state matters a lot to how people perceive Northwest Arkansas, because they hear Northwest Arkansas and they're thinking Arkansas. And so if Arkansas is not doing well, then people don't think of Northwest Arkansas as a region that does well as well, especially for people, you know, from outside the region that don't know.
So looking at the state as a whole, you have this corner that's doing well in other parts of the state.
The other corner, so the Northwest corner, that's where we are doing well. Northeast corner, that's where Jonesboro is, that's doing well. And then the central part, Little Rock, has done pretty well in the last year, much better than previous years, actually. So you have two corners and the middle part of the state doing well, and then the rest of the state isn't particularly doing well, which was not the case from 2014 to 2017. During that time period, all of these regions did well, and the rural areas did well as well.
So what changed?
I just think that the economy is not growing as fast as it did between, you know, the recovery that we had from the last recession was kind of delayed. And so it really hit its stride between 2014 and 2017 and then sort of, you know, stopped growing as fast. And Northwest Arkansas is not growing as fast as it did in 2018 or in 2019, like it did between 2014 and 2017. We were growing 3.5%, 4.5% back then. We're growing about 2% now.
So Northwest Arkansas is not growing as fast. Is that something that me as a Northwest Arkansan should be concerned about? Because does there come a point where, you know, you're going to reach a plateau? It's not going to keep being, it's not necessarily negative. It's just there's a threshold.
I think we couldn't possibly sustain 4.5% growth year over year. So 2.5 is probably more sustainable in the long run. And, you know, that's still 5,000-6,000 jobs in any given year. Would we like to have faster growth? Sure, but there are problems that come with that too. But, you know, how tight the labor force is, whether there's enough housing for all the people that want to move in here and all of those things. So a little bit, you know, the pace that we have now is probably fine if we were just looking at Northwest Arkansas. But when we consider that Northwest Arkansas generates most of the jobs or half the jobs in the state, then you kind of want to have as many more jobs as you can so your state's numbers look better too.
So it helps the state as a whole look good.
Yeah, so those times when the state was growing faster between 2014 and 2017, growing about 20-something thousand jobs in a year, Northwest Arkansas was growing a lot faster and adding 7,000-9,000 jobs. So that makes up, again, a bigger portion of the state's total.
And you mentioned some problems that come with growing so quickly. Is infrastructure one of those?
You know, yeah, we've seen a lot of investments in roads. You know, those will probably get filled up just very quickly. The biggest problem we have really is housing affordability in Northwest Arkansas, which doesn't seem like a situation that many people think about, but home prices have grown about 25% or so in the last 5 years, which is pretty remarkable, higher in some cities than that. So, again, about 40% or so of the people moving to Northwest Arkansas come from other parts of Arkansas, and Benton and Washington County have the highest home prices in the state. You know, in some cases, more than $100,000, the average price of a home in Washington County than, say, Pope County.
$100,000 more.
Right.
Oh, wow.
So $130,000 home in Pope County is $230,000 average home here in Washington County. So that's quite a significant step up for somebody trying to move to seek economic opportunity here in Northwest Arkansas.
What are some of the downsides, I guess, of having these areas of the state that are doing so well, but other parts that are not doing so great?
I would say the biggest downside is, you know, once an area is not doing well, it gets into this negative spiral where jobs leave, people leave, and then the region or locality can't support the infrastructure that they have, can't support the schools that they have, they can't support the remaining existing businesses, they don't have much of a tax base and all of these things. And it's easy to argue, well, there are jobs in Jonesboro, there are jobs in Northwest Arkansas, there are jobs in Central Arkansas, people should move. But if you just look at statistics or look around you and the people you know, most people don't move. Most people live generally within the region that they were born and went to school in. So it's easy to say, well, people should move, but people don't move. And so it's very hard to say, well, just move to Northwest Arkansas and get a job. Now, some people do move, clearly, but And for them, it's important that home prices are affordable so that they can make that move. But the, you know, most people just don't move. So the question is, how do you take economic development to them as opposed to saying, I'll just pack your bags up and move to Northwest Arkansas or Jonesboro or something like that.
Is it better for the state overall to have a more evenly spread out economic development versus having it in certain pockets?
I think so. I think it certainly makes the state stronger. There are different sectors of our state economy. There are different people that have trained for, you know, different job sectors and live in different places of the state, and their skills aren't easily transferable. So it is better to take that economic development to them than to try to retrain a vast number of people across the state and get them to move somewhere else.
Is it a lot of pressure to forecast something because you are guessing?
We're estimating. And yeah, I mean, we get it wrong. And as long as we know why we were wrong, it's fine.
What's an example of why you were wrong?
Sometimes, you know, we were projecting slightly higher manufacturing employment in 2018. And come February and March, the president announces that he's imposing steel and aluminum tariffs. And there goes that forecast. So, you know, as long as I'm able to point to and say, well, this is why the forecast was wrong. Mm-hmm. That was at the statewide level. We were expecting slightly higher manufacturing jobs because we've had increases in manufacturing employment in the state over the past several years. It slowed down in 2018. We've seen a lot of plants cancel their expansion plans, and some plants that were planning to open up, plants that were planning to open up, never did because of the tariffs. So, you make mistakes in forecasts. As long as you know why you made the mistake, it's fine.
Mervin, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
That was Mervin Jemiraj, director of the Center for Business and Economic Research at the University of Arkansas. He spoke with Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda at the Carver Center for Public Radio yesterday afternoon. You can find out more about the region's economic forecast at cber.uark.edu.
91.3 is supported by Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art, presenting Men of Steel, Women of Wonder, a new exhibition featuring Superman and Wonder Woman as seen by the art world through more than 70 works by a wide range of artists. Opening on February 9th. More information at crystalbridges.org.
Ahead on this Tuesday, Ozarks at Large, there is much that can be learned from studying engineering from antiquity. And Kevin Hall, a professor in the College of Engineering at the University of Arkansas, says examining engineering from the past and the present can lead to conversations about all aspects of society.
The themes themselves are going to be universal in terms of looking at societal challenges, looking at solutions to those challenges. And there's another aspect to the class that I'm very excited about. Everybody gets excited about technology and technological change. We see them almost inevitably as advances. But technological solutions can also have unintended consequences.
Kevin Hall tells us how he's preparing to teach a semester about engineering antiquity ahead on today's Ozarks at Large.
The government shutdown is over, and President Trump will finally address the nation from inside the House chamber. Will party leaders settle on a plan for border security?
If we make a fair deal, the American people will be proud of their government for proving that we can put country before party.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Join me for NPR's special coverage of the 2019 State of the Union address from NPR News.
The State of the Union and the Democratic Party response live tonight, beginning at 8. On 91.3 KUAF. The State of the Union and the business of this state get the attention of John Brummett and Roby Brock this week. Their conversations take place here most weeks. John Brummett is a political writer for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, and Roby Brock is with our partner, Talk Business and Politics. Their conversation this week covers the earliest weeks of the Arkansas legislature and tonight's State of the Union. Roby asked John Brummett what he expects to have happen in Washington tonight.
Here's what I expect. Nothing stays the same very long in American politics. And during a couple weeks ago, when the story was all that Trump had spectacularly lost the shutdown and was losing ground even among his base and was probably finished, I thought, well, in a couple of weeks or at some point, She's going to have to let him give the State of the Union. And a State of the Union has become the most absurd stagecraft of modern politics. It's an occasion for an embattled president to go seem grand and important. You know, they announce his name in a very dramatic way. He comes in, he towers over the Congress. Mrs. Pelosi will need to sit behind him as if deferential, you know. And then nearly everything he says will be cheered by half the people, while the others, by not cheering, will risk being cast by the swing voters out there as symptoms of the over-partisanship of Washington. And then if he does it right, and I predict that he will, because I think he knows he's got to repair himself, he will give a non-Trump address. He will do a Bill Clinton-like litany of good programs that he wants to do. He's going to talk about how we need to get together and do something on this infrastructure. We need to get together and do something about the rising cost of prescription drugs. And I think, and he will avoid a great deal of combative or alienating rhetoric. And I believe he also will mention, for the benefit of his conservative base, the abortion issue, which has sprung up with late-term abortion permissions being proposed in states like New York and Virginia, which is he's being encouraged to include some reference to that. I think he'll have a good night. It's all set up for him to have a good night. What will go wrong is if he veers from the teleprompter with some of his egomaniacal asides. Everything is set up. Remember, Bill Clinton lost the midterms spectacularly, 1993,
yep.
Then got up and read Dick Morris's dictated line, "The era of big government is over." Remember that? Was the era of big government over? No.
No.
Is it over now?
No.
But it let him co-opt the Republican theme from the midterms and take advantage and co-opt for himself the big themes coming out of the midterms. And it meant nothing other than it was stagecraft.
All right, let's turn our attention to the Arkansas State Capitol. Last week, Asa Hutchinson, our governor, puts forth a revised tax cut plan, $97 million, a little bit smaller than what was previously expected. Still gets to that 5.9% highest income tax rate in 2 years' time. Does this unclog the process of everything else that has kind of been in a holding pattern up at the state capitol?
You know, I've heard you say that, and I know that you know what's going on, and I've never known exactly what it was going to unclog. If you mean, and tell me if you do, that you really can't proceed to any sort of substance that entails a budget or spending or policy for the next biennium until you have some reasonable idea of what that budget's going to be.
Yes.
Is that what you mean?
That's what I mean.
Well, sure. That's true. You can't proceed to the serious business until this is done, and I think we can assume he'll probably get this passed. But I've been covering, you've covered him a long time, I've covered him longer. These sessions always start slow. Mm-hmm. And even if you have a pretty good idea what the budget's going to be, the first few weeks are spent on microchipping bills and undoing minimum wage or some out of the blue weird thing that comes
something
up.
Something you didn't see out there on the radar.
Because it
basically.
Just somebody, I think it was a late speaker, or former speaker John Paul Capp said, these things are terribly hard to start, but even harder to stop. Meaning they just spin out there for a few weeks and then they realize, we need to get home and work on our taxes and tend to our business. And so everything gets pushed at the end. It's just human nature. But yeah, however, I will say this, and see if you think this is so. If your concern is, what is our general revenue budget and how do we spend it and what can we count on? It is true that if you have a pretty good idea what the governor's tax plan is, if it's feasible and if it's likely to pass, then you can proceed. But if you're still hung up wondering how you're going to do a highway program, and if apparently some element of the highway program is we want to by some method chip into general revenue, divert some general revenue to highways, which I think is on the table. You remain uncertain, don't you? There still
you
may be
the
some.
The governor has said pretty emphatically he's opposed to that idea. So I think you would have to have something that would be veto-proof. And as you well know, you don't typically get any kind of highway plan passed successfully without a governor's support.
I guess that's true, even though Bill Clinton once vetoed one for a show and then said, please go override me because I promised I wouldn't raise taxes. So there's always a Clinton exception that I can cite to these sorts of rules. But I think, I didn't know that Hutchinson, had said that emphatically. He has in the past.
He has in the past.
Yeah.
I don't think he's going to shift to this point.
There is some proposal out there that would tap general revenue for highways on some contingency basis based on the health of general revenue. Mm-hmm. You've seen that? That's a possibility, I would think. All of that makes it uncertain. But my point is, yeah, it unclogs, but it's going to stay clogged. These guys are just going to wander around for a few more days anyway.
John Brummett is a political writer for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, and his columns can also be found at ArkansasOnline.com. He talked with Roby Brock from our partner Talk Business and Politics. You can hear more from them at talkbusiness.net.
Today's morning routine was just like yesterday's. Same toothpaste, same breakfast. But what was happening in the world outside your door was anything but ordinary. Progress, unrest, lives changed forever. Every weekday starts out the same until you listen. Turn on Morning Edition and the world will open up before your ears in a way that opens your eyes. Start every day fully awake with Morning Edition from NPR News.
Morning Edition can be heard tomorrow and every weekday morning from 5 to 9 on 91.3. There are modern, if underappreciated, engineering marvels all around us. Each of those tall bridges along Interstate 49 connecting the Arkansas River Valley in northwest Arkansas are the culmination of mathematics and design. And many of the engineering feats we use and take for granted in 2019 have a relationship with engineering from centuries or longer ago. Next fall, Kevin Hall, a professor in the College of Engineering at the University of Arkansas, will lead an Honors College signature seminar called Engineering Antiquity. And a week from tonight, he'll offer a preview lecture for the public at 5:15 in the Gearhart Hall Auditorium on the U of A campus. Recently, we asked Kevin Hall about getting ready for the talk and for the course. He says while we don't know everything about engineering of the past, there is plenty of ground he can cover in a semester's time.
Oh, there's plenty we don't know, but there is plenty we do know. When you go back, and one of the challenges, honestly, of this course is going to be trying to capture the totality of it. And we do not hope to capture the totality of it. When you look at technological advance in China, when you look in the Middle East, obviously, when in Western society, we think about the Greeks and the Romans, but even in Central and South America, in some parts of North America, the different solutions that ancient peoples developed to problems that we still face today are pretty spectacular.
So will you be looking at specific items in antiquity, specific structure?
We will. The way we're going to structure the class, so it meets one day a week. It will be one seminar per week. And the way that we propose to structure it is we will take a topic each week. One week might be military technology. One week might be water supply technology. One week will be mathematics, because without it, you couldn't do the things that you do. One week would be building construction, and so on and so on. And so we'll try to look across cultures and across the world at how the same challenges people faced, what were the various solutions that they came up with in order to meet those challenges.
When you talk water supply, things like aqueducts and...
Absolutely. And that's one of the things that kind of drew me to this topic. When you think about what society needs, you think about clean water, you think about a steady food supply that is safe and that you can distribute. You think about buildings that you can live and work. You think about transportation systems. You think about defense. Those across time have always been societal needs. We meet them a certain way today. They met them in some ways similarly in antiquity, but in some ways very differently. And so that's one of the things we want to explore.
Are there such things as blueprints from antiquity?
Some. It depends on how far you go back. Mm-hmm. Certainly from we'll call it generally the Renaissance era forward, you can still find some original drawings. I lead a study abroad group to Italy from time to time. And one of the things that we look at is Brunelleschi's dome at the Duomo in Florence. And there are still drawings from that structure and very detailed plans of how Brunelleschi went about constructing that dome. And so you can find things like that. You go back further, it gets a little bit more problematic. But at the same time, Vitruvius wrote his 10 books of architecture well before that, thousands or hundreds of years before that. So it just depends on how hard you can look.
This class is not only open to engineering students.
No, in fact, I expect there will be more non-engineering students than there will be engineering students in it, because the themes themselves are going to be universal in terms of looking at societal challenges, looking at solutions to those challenges. And there's another aspect to the class that I'm very excited about. Everybody gets excited about technology and mm-hmm. technological change. We see them almost inevitably as advances. But technological solutions can also have unintended consequences and can sometimes backfire. And one of the things that we want to look at are some of the ethics behind technological advance. We want to look at things where and I'll give you an example. We want to look at things where, let's say, a technological advance, many technological advances, are to automate a process that humans do. Well, so that's a great invention, and it saves so much time and it saves so much labor. Maybe it's more cost effective. But what about the humans who did that? What does it do to them? They are displaced. They're unemployed. So technology is great, but there are consequences to it. And one of the questions that I want this class to fully consider is not the question of can we build it, mm-hmm. but should we build it?
Were there things like the Industrial Revolution in antiquity?
There were advances and retreats. In fact, one of the most fascinating things in Western society is the idea that we learned so much from the Greeks, from Euclidean geometry to Archimedes to whatever. The Romans picked that up, and the Romans were incredible engineers. And yet, from the and I hesitate to say fall of Rome. That's an antiquated phrase.
Right.
But from let's say the mid 5th century through almost to the Renaissance, Western Europe lost so much of that technology, so much of that know-how, so much of that ability to meet those challenges that they faced. The technology itself and the knowledge of that technology disappeared. And it took until almost the Renaissance to bring that back. And so that's an interesting question itself. How can society lose technology?
Right. Right. So, that seems so counterintuitive.
It really does. And yet there are writers out there that have posited that could even go on now.
Well, I guess in a way, I don't know, tell me if this is an elegant example, but, you know, like churning butter. Mm-hmm. If it's something you haven't had to do for decades or centuries, and then suddenly
it's lost.
Yeah.
I do read quite a bit of fiction, and one of my favorite series of all time is Isaac Asimov's Foundation series. One of the things that Asimov posits in that series, you have a literally galaxy-spanning empire, and yet they start to fall into ruin because they literally have forgotten how to operate and engineer the very systems that made that empire possible. Because the technology was so specialized and so many people didn't want to go. I mean, it's always been there, will always be there. So I don't want a job in that area. That's very boring. And they lost the ability to maintain what they had. And this is obviously science fiction, but it's the same theme as what we've seen in certain periods of history.
What I love about this is you're brushing off the dust off of antiquity. So many of us, when we hear that word, I think, well, that's the past, the far past. Mm-hmm. And, well, yes, we're standing on the shoulders of people who came before us, but it doesn't have that much relevance to where we are now and where we're going. But
Oh, yeah.
And it does.
It very much does. And you've hit upon one of probably the major motivations and the major themes behind the class is this idea that rather than looking back and saying how quaint, we look at their actual solutions to problems. And we can, I believe we can bring those thought processes forward to the very same challenges we're facing today, because their challenges were very similar to our challenges. They were able to meet those challenges. Mm-hmm. What have we forgotten that they knew that we could apply to today?
What a great audience to have for this once a week seminar, people who are 19, 20, 21 years old.
Absolutely. This generation, and I can tell you, this is my 26th year of teaching engineering at the University of Arkansas. This generation that we are raising right now and educating right now face very different challenges than even I did when I graduated, because so much is in place now. And I'm a civil engineer, so I'll talk infrastructure. So much infrastructure is in place, and yet the condition of that infrastructure continues to degrade. It's not building new as much anymore. It's actually how do you refurbish, how do you maintain, how do you make that cost effective? And so it's a suite of different challenges now. And so I think, again, by looking back and looking at where we came from, we can learn a lot about where do we need to go.
Is it ever frustrating for you or your colleagues that most of us, when we think about engineering, we think about where the rivet goes and how the bridge is going to hold up, and we don't think about the broader implications?
I don't think it frustrates a lot of us. I think many of us who span the gap between the technology itself and then education, I think there's a very big realization that we have kind of created that ourselves, because most of the public does not understand what engineers do. Well, whose fault is that? Well, you can lay a big part of that blame at the feet of the engineers. One of the things that we continue to preach to our students right now is the absolute need for transparency and open and simplified communication. The idea that you talk to non-engineering audiences, and one of the things I stress to my students is making it to where a non-engineering audience can understand it. And I want to emphasize to them, it's not because they're not smart enough. That has nothing to do with it. It's because they don't speak the same language sometimes that we do.
Right. And I see what you're saying, but I think you can't lay – I mean, there might not just be fault in some places.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you're speaking Mandarin and I speak English and we don't speak each other's language,
right.
I mean, there's no fault there.
There's no fault there. I think, though, that engineers can do a better job of helping the public understand what we do and the challenges that we face. And so I think, you know, it's kind of incumbent upon us. We can stand over and say, oh, people don't understand us. But at the same time, it's kind of incumbent upon us to help that misunderstanding.
Journalists kind of feel that pain at times.
Absolutely.
Someone's going to bring up the pyramids.
Of course.
I mean, what do we not know about? I mean,
we
can fill a pyramid with what we
don't
know.
And, you know, I chuckle a little bit because one of the things I would love to entertain with the students when we're talking about things like that are some of the other theories that are out there. You know, how in the world could the pyramid builders have aligned the pyramids in such astronomically perfect alignment? And so you think about the crazy theories out there. You think about aliens visiting.
Eric von Däniken.
Absolutely. Chariots of the Gods.
Yeah.
So I'm going to have a little fun with the students on some of that. But certainly, you know, it's one thing to talk about how they were constructed, and we know a lot about that. Certainly the why they were constructed in terms of tombs and other things. But we're left to speculate a little bit on things like how they were sited, you know, how they were aligned. There's an underlying theme there that we just have lost, that we just probably will never understand. But the fact that given the tools that they had and the incredible craftsmanship that is shown in that construction, I think that's the lessons we're going to take away from. You know, in fact, one underlying element here is craftsmanship. Mm. So much, you know, we depend so much on technology now to guarantee craftsmanship. But in an era that they didn't have that same kind of technology, they still had craftsmanship that we are hard matched. It's hard to match that craftsmanship today.
You know, I'm thinking about the pyramids, and then I think about infrastructure that has been built over time. You can't really look at railroads without thinking about the exploitation of Asian labor.
Absolutely.
Slave labor that built up an economy, and the pyramids. That's another ethical
subject. Is. It very much is. And that is a topic that we're going to put at the very forefront. I mean, when you think about technological advance and you think about the darker side of technological advance, your examples are exactly right. I think about some of the best research, unfortunately, on things like hypothermia came out of concentration camps using human subjects. The ethic of that. I mean, even today, we're seeing genetic modification, or at least reported in China, genetic modification. And, you know, the scientific community is sitting up and saying, wait a minute, this needs a lot more discussion. And so that builds into that question of should we rather than can we? A lot of times, people who are in the technology fields, they're pushing. We can. And one of the things I want the students to come back from this is, wait a minute, should we?
The very mining of what goes into our cell phone,
yes,
creating problems in the Democratic Republic of the Congo.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yes. And the fight for resources and what that can lead to.
Well, and those are the issues. When you have issues of unequal distribution of resources, unequal distribution of the things that all society needs, then you start getting into conflict then. Technology can be a help to that because maybe we can invent things that don't need that particular resource. At the same time, we have to recognize the human component to this. So one of the reasons I love this being in the Honors College at the university is that this is not a class necessarily about technology. This is a class about how technology and human society have evolved together. And that's one of the big things I want to emphasize here.
This isn't happening, the seminar itself, for some time because it's the next semester. Your talk is, as you and I sit here, still a couple of weeks or so away. But I'm wondering, as you're beginning to think about what you're going to cover, both in the public talk and in the seminar, do you become more, less optimistic, or do you just take an analytical approach?
Honestly, I'm a little overwhelmed. I mean, just in this conversation, we have touched on a lot of themes. So one of the biggest challenges to creating a course like this is the selectivity. What are you going to select to cover? What are you not? And so even in the public in the public talk that's coming up here in a couple of weeks, that's going to be a huge issue, is what am I going to talk about for this class and what am I not? Because for everything we put into this class, there's going to have to be something left out, probably three or four things left out. And so everything that we do in the class is going to have to point us toward what the stated outcomes are going to be. And so that's the task over the next 2 to 3 months, is to sift through thousands of years of development and say, okay, what are the key elements? And one of the things that I hope the students are going to understand is when we cover something in class, it's not that we think it's more important than other things. It's just you have to choose.
Right.
And so so there are going to be so many things that are not going to be covered, but that could be fodder for future seminars. That could be fodder for future classes.
Or people to go investigate on their own.
Absolutely.
Outside of the, out of the seminar.
And that's one of the great things about the signature seminars in the Honors College, is that the students who will be in the seminar are going to be hungry And they're going to this. I'm hoping that this is going to spur their curiosity and their imagination and say, I want to learn more about that topic that we covered. And wait a minute, we didn't cover this topic. I'm going to go and I'm going to see what's going on with that topic as well.
Thank you so much for your time.
You bet.
I want to be in this course now.
Well, you're welcome. You bet.
Thank you. Right. Kevin Hall is a professor in the College of Engineering at the University of Arkansas. And next fall, he'll lead an Honors College signature seminar titled Engineering Antiquity. And a week from tonight, February 12th, he'll deliver a free and open-to-the-public preview of that course. That begins a week from tonight at 5:15 in Gearhart Hall Auditorium on the University of Arkansas campus. The talk will also be streamed through the Honors College Facebook Live feed. Tomorrow on Ozarks, Raven Cook explains why she's so interested in history and why history is so important for all of us.
And I think the value to it is really just having a broader sense of how people go about how they go about really building and organizing and reaching for change.
Raven Cook, founder and president of Foundations, Black History Educational Programming, talks to us about the delight and importance of exploring history. That's on tomorrow's Ozarks at Large at noon and 7 on 91.3 KUAF.
Washington Regional's Her Health Clinic provides comprehensive care for women of all ages, including gynecological exams, prenatal care and deliveries, infertility treatments, and women's primary care services. With two locations, Washington Regional's Women and Infant Center in Fayetteville and the Springdale Center for Health in Harbor Meadows. WRegional.com for more. The Arkansas Philharmonic Orchestra welcomes distinguished pianist Robert Henry and Music for the Heart Saturday, February 9th at 7 p.m. at Arend Arts Center in Bentonville. Winner of numerous international piano competitions, Henry will perform works from Rachmaninoff, Stravinsky, and Kachaturian. ArkansasPhilharmonic.org for tickets and information.
The Museum of Native American History in Bentonville is hosting Floyd Clown Sr., a descendant of historic Lakota Sioux leader Crazy Horse, tomorrow evening at 6:30, along with filmmaker and author William Mattson. Mattson has written a book on Crazy Horse based on the clown family's oral history. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports.
19th century Lakota Sioux leader Crazy Horse is historically notorious for defeating Lieutenant Colonel George Armstrong Custer's U.S. Army troops at the Battle of Little Bighorn in 1876 on the Crow Indian Reservation in Montana Territory. Also referred to as Custer's Last Stand, the defeat triggered violent retribution against the Lakota, Northern Cheyenne, and Arapaho by the 7th Cavalry Regiment and U.S. Army. Great Plains and other tribes at the time were systematically removed from ancestral lands to make way for white settlements, dislocated to desolate reservations with few resources. The American Indian population estimated to have been between 6 to 10 million prior to European contact was reduced to 250,000 by the turn of the 20th century. The Lakota, Northern Cheyenne, and Arapaho, however, tried to resist. One overwhelming victory occurred at a place called Greasy Grass. The battle has been widely documented by white scholars, but author William Mattson, in cooperation with contemporary descendants of Crazy Horse, has provided the indigenous perspective based on oral histories published in the book Crazy Horse, The Lakota Warrior's Life and Legacy. Mattson says while certain Lakota descendants have tried to stake a claim on Crazy Horse, the clown family is bona fide.
Yes, they have the probates, which are in the back of the book, which are really death certificates that tell who the father and mother and siblings and the family in each one. And they go all the way back to 1905. And they had the census and ration records and church records. and allotment and enrollment records to prove their identity.
Matson built an alliance with the Clown family, who inhabit the Cheyenne River Reservation in South Dakota. They shared their oral history for the record with him.
Then I wrote it, and I wrote it from the first person, so that I wrote it the way that they told it to me. And that took about a year. After 12 years of going out to the oral history sites, which had landmarks and reference points. So when they told it to me, I had a visual. And then after writing it for a year, then there were 6 months of corrections, which at times I wasn't sure there was a light at the end of the tunnel. But we got all the corrections so that we're all on the same page. But it also told me some of those older books, like Black Elk Speaks and Wooden Leg, and some of those, they didn't know English, so they were not able to proofread what was written about them. So it was an opportunity to learn that firsthand. That when you come from a different culture, you have to work a little bit harder, and you have to listen a little bit closer, and then each family has their own oral history, and they say it, and you have to listen to it and correct it so that it is their story. It would have been a wrong for me to impose any of my thoughts. It would have been robbing the public, robbing the family, and ultimately robbing myself if I had imposed anything of my own opinions in the book.
Matson, along with various members of the Clown family, have traveled extensively, given hundreds of public talks about the book.
I think it's important for people to meet the family members, to put a face to the story. You know, I think it's important to also increase credibility because they're standing right there. Any questions about authenticity disappear?
Matson says those who attend the February 6th evening talk at the Museum of Native American History in Bentonville will come away with a rooted perspective.
An understanding of Native ways. People have a tendency to look at them as Native American, but that's just lumping everybody together. And that's not the way it was. It's a lot of misinformation. And so it's clearing that up, and that in the media and stuff and movies, they've always showed the warriors, but very seldom the families. And these are families. So it's an education process, an appreciation of natives and native ways, and the fact that this continent's history did not start with Christopher Columbus, started long before that, and to appreciate that.
Matson has produced and directed authorized film documentaries on Crazy Horse, as well as Sitting Bull, a Hunk Papa Lakota leader who also attempted to strategically resist U.S. policy encroachment on his land base. He was killed by Indian Agency police on the Standing Rock Indian Reservation in 1890. William Matson, who turned 70 last year, is currently working on a memoir about his collaborating with historic tribal families, as well as his tour of duty as a Vietnam War combat medic veteran and Purple Heart recipient. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
The Museum of Native American History is hosting author William Matson tomorrow evening at 6:30, along with Crazy Horse family elder Floyd Clown Sr., to discuss and sign the book Crazy Horse, The Lakota Warrior's Life and Legacy. You can find the Museum of Native American History in Bentonville. It's almost time to end this Tuesday edition of Ozarks. Contributors to this Tuesday show included Antoinette Grajeda and Jacqueline Froelich. Timothy Dennis once again mastered our show today. Antoinette, by the way, also curates the music that ends many of her broadcasts. Our conversation between John Brummett from the Arkansas Democrat Gazette and Roby Brock with our partner Talk Business and Politics was recorded at the TV studios of KATV and came to us through our partnership with Talk Business and Politics. And, of course, we have another show tomorrow at noon and 7 on 91.3 KUAF. A listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas, this is 91.3 KUAF. Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, and Siloam Springs. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I mentioned that we often end our shows with music. We're going to do that for this edition of Ozarks at Large. This is music recorded exclusively for Ozarks at Large at the Carver Center for Public Radio from Jamie Lou and the Hullabaloo. You can catch them live Thursday night at George's Majestic Lounge on Dixon Street in Fayetteville. If you'd like to know more about the band, you can go to their website, jamieluandthehullabaloo.com. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks for spending some time with us. Back tomorrow.
Something you don't see, yeah, it's a cool